This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
It's very good to be here, especially at a function of Manning Clark House. Thank you all for coming. Writers, I've been a writer for the last 40 years or so. Before that, I was a teacher, and writers and teachers really are among the people in the society who care most about language. I would say that as a writer, I care about language particularly because I think of the English language as being the place that is my real home. Nation is one thing, community is one thing, and both of those things are important. But essentially, for a writer, the language is the place where he most deeply belongs. So I have great concern about the language, both as a teacher and a writer. But I do want to just say something about that concern. I'm not worried about change in the language. Language is essential. Change is essential to any language. And English, of all languages, is the language in which change has been most important to the making of it. I am worried about the decay of the language. I'd also want to say that I make a distinction between the language as it's spoken and the language as we write and read it. And I'd really want to speak a little bit about the limitations of both. Of course, literacy is very, very important. And, you know, we take a great deal of trouble these days with the literacy of our children. We're enormously worried about the fact that Aboriginal children, for example, do not have standards of literacy like the rest, because literacy essentially in a society like ours is power. And if the society is in any kind of way to be just, literacy is one of the keys to it. But I would just point out that literacy is a very, very late phenomenon. And most societies have been illiterate and some of them literate to a small degree and largely illiterate. And one of those societies was, say, the world that Shakespeare grew up in. Illiteracy does not necessarily mean that you do not have a rich grasp of the world's experience. And one of the things I would want to say about Shakespeare, he was fortunate in coming at a moment when the English language absolutely exploded in terms of vocabulary. He was also very fortunate in having grown up in a largely illiterate society. That is a society in which people get most of their experience by listening hard and looking hard. And we would not have anything like the richness of experience that goes into Shakespeare, for example, if his way of life had not largely been based on the fact that most of his experience came to him in the way of illiterate people, by close looking and listening. So, you know, when we talk about literacy, we do need to remember that most of the world produced the large number of things that we value and regard as absolutely culturally indispensable at a time when it was largely illiterate. The other thing I would want to say against language is that we live in a society now when we have more language than we can deal with. I don't suppose there can be any time in the world's history when we were so absolutely bombarded with language, most of it ephemeral, useless, time-wasting. And what I mean by that is that the television runs for 24 hours a day on channel after channel after channel, pouring words into our head. The radio goes on all day with pouring words into our head. We so many of the occasions that we find ourselves at, like book launches, for example. And book launches are a peculiarly Australian phenomenon. You go to a book launch and someone stands up while you have to stand there and talks for three quarters of an hour about the book that is being launched, and the author then gets up and talks for another half an hour. I mean, we don't need most of the words that we are bombarded with. And, you know, the overuse of language is a large contributor to the debasement of language. You know, language is precious enough stuff, words are, that we ought to be more chary of their use, particularly on those kinds of public occasions. But the amount of noise that language now gives rise to is a serious problem, it seems to me. One of the other reasons why I'm concerned about language is because really the language we speak is not simply the language in which we communicate. It's the language in which we think. And it is the kind of thinking we do in a language is determined by the kind of language it is. I mean, thinking in English is not like thinking in Italian or thinking in German or thinking in Chinese. And it's not only that what the language contains is its own culture, which we all grow up in, its own traditions of institutions and all of those things which are absolutely embedded in the language, it is that the actual shape and syntax of a language determines the kind of thinking you can do in it. And it's no accident that the kind of empirical bias of most Anglo-Saxon derived thought and the aversion that kind of world has to theory and to abstraction is part of what the language itself presents. You know, whenever that language produces its culture, it is a culture in which example, specifics, particularities are always prioritized, to use that horrible word, over principle. And that's one of those ways in which, say, the whole British world is so absolutely different from the continental world. And why, you know, whatever respect we have for French or German thinking, basically its way of looking at the world is repulsive to us. And has resulted in truly terrible things, which our world has mostly been protected from. One of the things that is so liberating about English is an absolutely bastard language. It has no investment in the kind of purity of language that, say, French and German has, that kind of way in which the French are always jumping up and down because the language is being invaded by English vocabulary, for example, or the way Germans have always resisted using Latin or Greek terms for new products in a way that they feel is antithetical to the language. So, you know, they'd rather say Fernsehen rather than television, for example. You know, two nice German words put together in that habit of German of putting words together and making new words and illustrating new concepts by putting older words together. We mostly don't do that. We're very happy to import into the language all those Greek and Latin words. And that's because the language was always a bastard language. It began as a Germanic language in Anglo-Saxon, and then, you know, after the Norman invasion, it became really a Frenchified German language. And then at a certain point, when people perhaps saw the advantage of that in the Renaissance, they decided the best thing to do was to absolutely flood the language with new derivative words from Latin and Greek. And, you know, what then constitutes the particular quality of English is the huge vocabulary we have and the huge number of synonyms we have for similar things. You know, if you look at English poetry, for example, and then look at a German or Italian poetry, you see how absolutely narrow the vocabulary is in those other languages and how much of the meaning of the same word in those languages depends on context. We don't do it that way. We have this vast range of synonyms for all sorts of nuances of feeling so that we don't have to use the same word. And poetry, for example, doesn't... The meaning of a word in English poem doesn't depend nearly so much on context as in Italian or German, for example. And so that's part of the history of the language that has determined how the language is, and my concern about that would be, as I'll come to in a moment, the watering down of that richness of the vocabulary and that nuance of words in the language, because of there are other accidents of history which now affect English. One of those accidents of history is that it was English, for example, it was England that produced an industrial revolution. And that led to England becoming the dominating economic power in the world. It led to their having a huge empire. It led to the rise of one of those originally colonial places, America, as a power even larger than the power of England once it replaced it in the 20th century. And what that has done has made English the universal language, the lingua franca of this planet at this time, and one wants to say from this point on. And I would strongly suggest that what that means, if we look at the precedence of history, virtually the end of the English language as we know it. Once a language becomes a lingua franca, spoken in the marketplace by millions of people who actually have no access to the complexity of the language, who have not been educated mostly in the language, so they don't understand the relationship between the structures of the language and the culture and traditions of the language. Once language has fallen to the point where all it is a system of ready and immediate but mostly shallow communication, then that language dies. That language, that use by the majority of people in the world of that language in a shallow and ignorant way eventually feeds back into the main sources, places of the language, and the language disappears. And the other reason why the language disappears at something like that point, and I'm thinking of what happened to both Greek and Latin, the other reason why that language becomes threatened is because the quality of the language and the quality of a culture always depends on the best users of the language and the best thinkers in the culture and the most cultivated people. And if those people change their value system, then the language and the literature of the language can largely disappear. I mean, that happened to Latin. We now know that the classical languages, about 80% of all writing in Italian, in Latin, disappeared by the 3rd century. If you look at Greek language, of the 400 or 500 plays that were produced in classical drama, we have plays of only 3 tragic dramatists and Aristophanes. And of the tragic dramatists, we have 9 each of Sophocles and Aeschylus, and another 9 plus a few more of Euripides. And they survived only because the Alexandrian world, classics were chosen and put in an anthology, and only the plays that were put in that anthology for a few elite students have actually survived. All the rest disappeared. Virtually the whole of Greek science would have disappeared, and all of Greek philosophy would have disappeared, and all of Greek lyric poetry, for the simple reason that the most highly educated people in that society, when they turned to Christianity, decided that all of these things were vanities and were no longer to be read. And if a book at that time was no longer read, a text was no longer copied, and if a text was no longer copied, it disappeared. And about 90% of all literature and thinking in those cultures disappeared because the best educated people in the society had changed their values. And what you have to watch out for in a society like ours is what kind of thinking we are doing when it comes to valuing the literature. And, you know, I would just strongly suggest that if you look at what goes on these days in academic English departments, literature is doomed. I mean, it is, you know, literature is absolutely of no value in most academic English departments now unless it has some social value. And once you do that, it's gone. The other thing that I just want to say quickly is we do have, in another kind of way, to be extremely wary of overvaluing language to this extent, that one of the things that's again happened in our universities is, for purely business reasons, almost all places where people once practiced arts, whether it was the visual arts or music arts, those places have now been incorporated into universities where they have absolutely no place. And one of the things that happens there is because value and overvalue language over other kinds of things, is that a person who is training to be a performer or a dancer, a musical performer or a dancer, or a composer, is now required to write a thesis on what they're doing, as if that kind of self-conscious analysis had anything to do, finally, with performance. That is just a kind of nonsense in which you say that the articulation and the translation into language of things which language has no place in is a necessary part of practice. And, you know, I mean, much as I love and admire language as important as I think it is, there are places where it does not belong. And what that all that illustrates is yet another example of the way we are flooded with language, which we don't need in places where language is absolutely not at home. The other thing, and whenever I listen to Don Watson, I'm always enormously amused and then enormously depressed. And I'm just going to end on a note of even greater depression. One of the things that's has happened in our society is that, for whatever reason, over the last 30 or 40 years, economics has become the guiding principle of the culture. And once that has happened, economics not only takes over the whole management of the culture, but it also ends up providing the philosophy behind the culture and the language behind that philosophy. And that's largely what Don was talking about. And I don't know that there is now any way back from that. And it's interesting to see what that language is. Of course, in any language, there will always be multiple languages being used and spoken at any moment. We all have our own culture of language. And, you know, a writer particularly is interested when he's creating a character in a novel in what the peculiar language of that person is, because we make up our own language out of the large language. And, you know, some of that is determined by experience, some of that is determined by gender, some of that is determined by the profession we belong to. So I'm not wanting everyone to speak the same language or speaking against the fact that we have multiple languages and that we make up our own language out of that great pool. But the way in which the language of business language, executive language, managerial languages has now taken over almost everywhere is not simply the matter of people in a particular profession speaking their jargon, but it has behind it a kind of philosophy that says the only thing that really matters is the world of business. The only philosophy that needs to be applied in almost any context is one which will work in business, and the only language in which that can be done is this kind of language. It's interesting just to see where that language has come from too, because partly, it is a language of pseudoscience. And that pseudoscience is the language which comes originally from the social sciences, not from the sciences that are based on fact, but sciences which are based on speculation. And the social sciences, when they needed to establish their legitimacy, took over the language of real science and pretended that that language applied to the pseudosciences, which are the social sciences. And what has then happened after that is the language of the humanities and the language of management has taken over the language of that pseudo-social science based on original science as, again, a way of legitimizing what they are presenting. And I think, you know, how we ever move back from that, I don't know. I was saying to somebody at morning tea break there is a way in which we can rebel against that. It's by having a kind of revolution. But the revolution starts with every single one of us. And I've got into the habit, if I'm now at a conference or sitting at a board table, I will simply say, I'm sorry, if you use that kind of language, I will leave the room. And I do.
Dave, thank you, David. David's going to take some questions, of course, but I get to ask the first few. So, as you're ready to ask a question, please indicate to our two roving mind people. Thank you, Dave.
Have I got to activate this?
No. Yes, you're right. Ready to go. Okay. In this latest novel of yours, Dave, Ransom, just in a couple of pages at the end, I can't remember if you call it the afterword or the epilogue or whatever, You mention Miss Finlay. Who's Miss Finlay?
Oh, I had a strange education because begins in a bit of family history. We had a girl who lived in the house. She was called the girl, but she was called Cassie. And she largely brought my sister and me up. And my sister's 2 years younger than me, and we fought a great deal. And then Cassie simply said, look, I was about four. And she said, look, either he goes or I go. And so I had to go to school, but of course there's no school for a four-year-old. So my mother looked in the paper and she found an advertisement of somebody who had a dame school in Blakeney Street, West End. And so I went to that school when I was four, and there were five of us to start with and about 10 of us by the end. And I was there for about 6 years. And then I went to West End State School. And at West End State School, my teacher was somebody called Miss Finlay. And in those days, you had the same teacher right through, so she taught us everything. And the story I tell there is that one afternoon we were supposed to go out and play tunnel ball on a Thursday afternoon. It was raining. And so instead of going out and playing tunnel ball, she read us the story of Troy. And that was the first time I think I ever heard that story. And I was kind of shocked by it. First of all, I translated all of that heroic stuff straight into the playground. So, you know, it was really all for me about Red Rover and schools, you know, the gangs in a schoolyard. And then also, particularly what struck me and made me very scared was the fact that this was 1943 and Brisbane was a city that was completely occupied by American soldiers. I mean, there were 200,000 American soldiers in the city, and the whole city, every building was sandbagged. And we were sort of sitting there waiting for the Japanese to come. So the story about a city that was under siege, which was inevitably going to fall and in which everybody was eventually going to be slaughtered, it wasn't to me very remote. And so, I mean, that became for me a kind of archetypal experience about war, about the use of force, about warriors, but really seen from the other side. I mean, not seen at all from the side of the people with the power, but from the side of the people who are about to get it.
So when you were a kid, you would have had the Queens... I know you've written about the Queensland Readers before, which yes. seemed to exist for years and years. Where does your love of language and love of story come from?
Oh, look, my mother read to me for as long as I can remember. And I also grew up in a kind of reading household because my mother and Cassie, and both of those women would have left school when they were 12 or 13, but they were highly literate, as you were if you went through Queensland University, Queensland primary education and read those readers. Those readers were initiated in 1906 and were in continuous use in Queensland until 1974. And so everybody who grew up in that state, all those writers would have absolutely been brought up on the same diet. And, you know, the idea of those things was that people would leave school at either 12 or 13, because only 7% of people in Queensland until 1957 went on to secondary school. But if they were to leave school at that age, they would have to be utterly numerate, utterly literate, and have already been introduced to virtually the whole of English poetry, and wads of Shakespeare, and 59 extracts from 59 novels. And, you know, the other people who were in there were Turgenev and Tolstoy and Victor Hugo and Dickens and Lincoln and Emerson. You know, all of that was there. So that was the literary background you grew up with. But in the house, my mother and Cassie read aloud to one another every afternoon. So I would, you know, from the age of three, I would be sitting there listening to whatever they were reading. And they were usually the old-fashioned books that my mother would have read previously when she was younger. So there were all those novels of Mrs. Henry Wood. I've read about 19 novels of Mrs. Henry Wood. I can't think there's any other any other person in Australia who's done that. And Mrs. Henry Craig and Hall Caine, all of, so those two women, every afternoon while they were doing whatever they were doing, sewing or peeling potatoes or shelling peas, they would take it in turns to read to one another. So I simply took it for granted that reading was the major activity that happened in the world. You know, if you're a little kid of five and you don't go out of the house and you're still growing up in that woman's world, which is where little boys start before they get chucked out, you know, reading seemed to me to be the major activity if you were not shelling peas or peeling potatoes, and the two things were connected.
So when did you then make the link from reader, that readers, someone, for you to be reading something, someone must have written it. So then when did you start to think of yourself as possibly a writer?
Well, first of all, I learned then to read spontaneously. I mean, I can't ever remember being taught to read, but because I followed the page while my mother was reading or something, I learned to read that way. And then the main thing was I realised that there were these, earlier than that, there were these marks on a page, just marks on a page, and somehow magically they became something you could read, you know, you could produce as a voice, and that became stories. And so that seemed right from the beginning, like, to me, like the one magic trick that was worth learning.
So when did you want to learn that trick to actually write?
Well, almost immediately, I would have thought. And I would have started trying to write something. But then I've often told the story that because I think it was in Little Women and Good Wives, which is another one of those books that I would have heard read aloud, I think Jo in that book and her other sisters produce a paper of their own, a newspaper of their own. And I thought that would be a really, really good idea. And I knew what should go into that. I was a very, very, very astute eavesdropper. And especially, you know, my mother, as I say, you know, I was still growing up in that world of women that you begin with. And my mother used to have people come in the afternoon to afternoon tea, and she had bridge parties. And those women would discuss all sorts of things, usually their husbands. And so I produced a little newspaper that told all the secrets, including the gossip about neighbours, and then distributed it in the neighbourhood. So that was my first literary effort.
So you were very patient in a way, because you didn't publish until 1975. Were you writing in that time, or in the lead up to 70, or was it you were busy as a teacher? Or
No. I was teaching in England from the beginning of 1959 until 1958. And during that time, I wrote the poems that went into my first book, which was published in 1962, which was just 12 poems in a book called Four Poets. And I wrote virtually all the poems that went into my first book, Bicycle, which was published in 1970 after I came back. And I wrote the first 6, 7, 8, whatever it was, drafts of Jono, which were all terrible, all during that period.
Yes.
So, but I didn't ever publish anything. And I've always done that. I've always not published poems until I have a book ready. And I've always made a distinction between writing and publishing. And I'm interested in writing and a lot less interested in publishing.
As a writer, do you have a project? Is there something that you're trying to do in your writing?
Well, usually it is to find out why I'm trying to write what I'm writing. You know, I mean, what I mean by that is that you pick up something and it's really a question, and you don't know why that particular thing nags away at you. And so you're really in writing whatever it is, whether it's a poem, which happens very quickly, or a novel, which you have to stick with for a very long time. For me, It's really trying to find out what's my connection with that that makes me not be able to let go of it. And so, you know, the writing is partly comes about because of the necessity of finding out something. In the end, it's usually something about yourself. And it's that business of trying to, you know, I usually think of experience out there as being something that's like a great big piece of material with thousands and thousands of hooks. And one of those hooks grabs hold of you, and you can't get free. And eventually what the book is whatever that hook pulls up out of you, which is connected with that other big thing out there. So the book really is a way of trying to find out something. And it's trying to find out what's your connection with that, why you have to worry about it, why you have to write it.
And are they questions that have nagged at you, say, in the years of leading up to that decision to do that? Or, are there major questions that you're pursuing? Or?
Yeah, well, I think that the reason why that one thing rather than another grabs hold of you is because there are a whole group of things that are the things that you're really concerned with. And I think that's the way in which you see that that writers go back and back to the same kind of subjects. And when we talk about a writer's, the body of a writer's work, we partly mean the set of concerns that belong only to him or to her and that distinguish them from other writers. But we also mean the works they've come up with which answer to that in some way. And, you know, so when we define, you know, the difference between Dickens and Dostoevsky and Balzac, to just name people who are connected, but who are very, very different from one another, it's because there are particular things we think of as Dickensian subjects or Dostoevskian subjects or Balzacian subjects. And that just means that they, too, keep going back to the same questions. But whether they're big writers or small writers depends on the range of those questions. Some people have more and bigger questions than others. They're bigger and bigger writers.
Well, just whilst the mic's going around, a question that's really intrigued me for a long time, and I wrote a piece in the Monthly about it, it was called What is Queensland? Have you come to an understanding of the place which you grew up in?
One of the things that interests me most about Australia is that, you know, we had to celebrate Federation in 2001 so noisily because it never really happened. And the states are very, very different from one another. If you've lived in Queensland, as I did for 24 years, and then lived in New South Wales, you know how very different places are. And it's because they have different histories. They begin in different places. They have a different demography. I mean, for one of the peculiar things about Queensland, which I think people don't understand, is that there were very, very few English settlers in Queensland. The settlers in Queensland were Irish, Scots, Welsh, and German. And for that reason, we speak a different language up there. And I didn't realise that until I went to England. And that when I tried to teach in a classroom in London, all the words I wanted to use in the classroom, the kids didn't understand, because they were not their words. They were Southern English words. And when I moved to the north of England and taught in Birkenhead, suddenly I was back with people who would use the same words in the classroom that I would. The word press, for example. You know, nobody in Queensland ever uses the word cupboard, practically, except of a kitchen cupboard. Anything else is a press. And where the books are kept in a schoolroom is the press. And that's exactly what you would do in Northern Ireland or in Scotland or in Northern England or Scotland or Ireland. It's not what you do in Southern England. But there are whole loads of words like that. So, you know, partly that's Queensland. It's another language and it's another history. But it's also something which I understand quite well, and that is that it's always been in Australian history the place which is both socially most backward and socially most progressive, both sometimes at once. And, you know, I mean, Queensland had a socialist government before anywhere else in Australia and instituted all sorts of social and welfare things that we now take for granted. I mean, decades before the rest of Australia. So, you know, it's a very, very complex and contradictory place. And I feel about a lot of aspects of it the way Faulkner must have felt, say, about the Deep South. You don't always approve of the way people think, but you actually understand why they think that way.
Let's have some questions.
Oh. Now that English has become the language of aviation throughout the world, in every country in the world, it's the English language that's used, small as the vocabulary may be, can we be excited about that?
Can we be excited about...
the fact that it is our language which is used as the language of aviation.
I mean, we can feel... I suppose we might feel proud in some kind of way of it, but I think it's fatal to the language. I really do think it's the end of the language. You know, I mean, all languages and all facts have strengths and weaknesses, and their strength is their weakness. And, you know, the weakness of English now is that it is the strongest language in the world.
Question?
Albert Voigt. I can understand what you say about the translation and translation from one language, from a language base into English. But I'm a bit concerned in relation, if I heard you correctly, in relation to English and its extensive use as a means of communication, perhaps more as a commercial language as opposed to a language of intimate communication. And because of the risks which, if I interpret you correctly, you suggest in relation to English, and we are communicating more or less by cipher, does that necessarily mean that we're undermining the need for cognitive analytical brain functioning, and that we may also undermine the aesthetic function of the frontal lobe? And so we might account for the apathy and lack of revolutionary zeal that we have in the community at the moment, maybe even extending into a conspiracy for subjugation of the population.
Not sure I understood all of that. sorry. I mean, what I would say is that language... I mean, this is an answer. I'm not quite sure of the last part because I really couldn't hear properly. But look, language at its best is a rich form of communication. And I think that's true as much between individuals or in families as in societies. Once language becomes simply a cipher for communication, so that really what is being communicated is not richly complex material, even in terms of feeling, as well as in terms of whatever kind of concepts you're dealing with, then something is really missing, not only in the language, but in the actual relationships between people. And, you know, I think most of the people, it's not true necessarily in societies where everybody is speaking the one language, or where everybody in that society is a native speaker of the language. But what we're mostly dealing with in societies these days, where English is spoken, is that people... very large numbers of people there have their own first languages and are using English as a second language of communication. Now, in a place like Australia, that can be very important, because I would say that the only thing that real settler societies like ours have that holds them together is the language that everyone speaks. So that, you know, this question is of particular importance in places like that are settler societies like ours. But I think you really do have to worry about the extent to which the language in which people are communicating is a kind of secondhand and diminished, thin language. Is that...
Rowley Sussex.
Yeah, Rowley Sussex. I'll be on later on with Sue Butler. I've got an anecdote and a question. The anecdote is about John Ralston Searle, the economist who is an anti-economist. I met him at the ABC a few years ago, and the ABC wanted to talk to him about his books, Voltaire's Bastards and the End of Globalization. The thing he wanted to do was to be taken to the bits of Brisbane which were behind Jono and the rest of David's writing. And it struck me that he'd got his priorities just about right. My question is about writing the activity. You talk about writing as if it's a friend, you know, something which you are engaged in. Are you a digital writer or a manual writer? Do you think before writing? Do you write while thinking?
I have to confess yet again, I've never owned a computer. And I still write by hand until quite recently. I was like Manning Clark, I still wrote with ink, mostly these days. And I think only because, you know, the nib broke and I didn't want to go to the park company to have it fixed up, I now write with Biro. But, you know, essentially I do that because I really do strongly believe in some kind of relationship between, you know, the hand and the brain. And something, for me, writing by hand is the right pace. It both allows me to leap ahead and, you know, have flashes that are leading the writing. But the other hand, it slows me up enough to do some critical thinking at the same time. You know, so for me, that's the right pace. And, you know, then I find it, you can do the right kind of correction. I do think also that not having a computer has enormously saved me from being bombarded with that kind of words that I don't want. You know, I resent the postman. So, you know, I basically don't want to be communicated with because I'm going to have to do something about it. So the idea of getting 30 emails a day just fills me with horror. And so I never want to, you know, people say if you had email, people would find it easy to communicate with you. And I said, that's why I don't have it. But the other thing is I don't want to give up the amount of time that people now seem willing to give up to their email and their computers. So, you know, I'm an absolutely unregenerate Luddite.
Well, we might finish with that image of you writing in our minds, David, but before you leave the stage, it's come to my attention that today is your birthday.
It is, yes.
So we have brought you a pineapple.
Thank you.
A banana. Some macadamia nuts and a voucher for a Weiss's Fruito Bar.
Good.
If you've ever been to Queensland, you know. But thank you very much, Dave and Luke. Thank you. And we have someone to sing our own. I know you love opera.
Yes.
So we have our own soloist to sing you happy birthday.
You might like to sit down, David.
I'll get out the way.
Happy birthday to little Sally Spingle Spungle Spawn, who on this wondrous day was born. And happy birthday also to Frederick Footson Bell, who was born upon this wondrous day as well. And happy birthday likewise to Waldo Wilberforce, Happy birthday also to Paul Revere's fine horse. You can tell it's an American song. But most of all, we sing to honor you, darling David.
Happy birthday. Thank you, David.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.